So I've done a count, because I'm a bit sad. I did a count recently. I kept a list of every bike I've had, and including 10 years in the bike trade, I've had 89 bikes registered to me in a lifetime of, what is it, 45 years or so riding. It's in the blood forever. It's my life, and I'll never not have a bike. You just need practical hands, basic tools, common sense, and a sense of humour. Because once you've got that, then I think you can achieve anything.
Hello there and welcome to Full Chat with me, David Prutton.
And me, Ewan Thomas, celebrating all things we love about being on two wheels. Now, Full Chat is powered by Bikesure. As the UK's largest independent motorcycle insurance broker, Bikesure will tailor a quote to your exact needs, helping you save money on your annual bike, scooter or moped insurance.
Don't forget to press subscribe on YouTube so you never miss an episode, or you can press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from.
Right, here we go. A great one lined up today, because today's guest has got literally one of the biggest YouTube channels when it comes to biking in the world. He is your go-to uncle for automotive expert maintenance and upgrades. Whatever you need to know, he is your man. He's got more than 250,000 regular subscribers. He's had over 65 million views to his weekly chats. He is, of course, the man behind Del Boy's Garage. It's Del Boy. Morning.
Good morning. Morning, chats. Thanks for having me. What an amazing privilege to be here.
The pleasure absolutely is all our. A long time watcher, my friend, subscriber. Just each and every video, my first port of call has been stand and stood in awe at the cleanliness of your workspace compared to when I've got spanners lying around everywhere, bits and bobs, things rolling down the drive. I mean, it's forensic the way that you work with your bikes, my friend. So how do you go from being such a skilled mechanic and bike specialist and then making it this YouTube sensation that it is?
Well, it started probably about 15 years ago. The first one we did was just in a home garage. I realized that a lot of people, I worked for 10 years in the bike trade, and I found that so many bikes would come in to stock that had been horribly neglected for many years because people either don't know how to do basic maintenance or they don't have the money to pay for it to be done. So bikes would come into stock needing quite a lot of work, and a lot of them were safety issues as well. So I found that it wasn't people didn't want to do it or couldn't afford it. They just didn't have the means or the wherewithal. So I chucked a video up on how to do an oil change and a clutch adjustment on a Harley Davidson. Two really simple jobs. And it just went berserk. Everybody loved it. Couldn't believe the love and respect we got back for it. So we did a few more and a few more. Yeah. And 15 years on, we've got a garage and seems to be a thing. But it is a thing that mechanics have to cost a lot of money. If you go to the garage and you go to the dealership to get your bike serviced, it is expensive. It's because it's a professional process. These days, for all of the right reasons, factories insist that the technicians that work on their motorcycles are qualified to a very high standard, at least to the standard of the factory technicians who build the bikes. And those guys are highly qualified. And any highly qualified person costs a lot of money. And if you're looking at £120 an hour for labor in your local garage, that's out of reach of many people, especially when the motorcycle is not often our primary transport. It is luxury. So it goes to the back of the queue when it comes to our finances. And that's what gave us the motivation to start. Chuck out some help to all our fellow riders to see if we can help them learn to do a few basic domestic servicing skills. Nothing dramatic, no major engine building, just oils and filters and fluids, which is what most motorcycle maintenance is all about.
Well, I tell you, I'm going to save myself 120 quid in a minute because I've got a question for you later on about my Harley. We need your expertise. But I think many people would assume this is your full-time job because, you know, doing YouTube, doing Instagram, social media, it's hard. Even just, you know, filming it and editing it takes so much time. But you've still got a full-time job, haven't you? So is this classified as a labor of love? You just enjoy what you do on the YouTube?
It's half and half. I have a part-time job. I work 25 hours a week and I do this. And this takes about 50 to 60 hours a week, as you just pointed out. Wow. A video that's produced maybe 10 minutes long is end-to-end from action to edited and online. That comes out as about 14 to 15 hours work and it's twice a week. And then, of course, lots and lots of questions, as you're going to ask in a minute. People ask questions. And they're not just people on the video asking a question about something in the video. They'll just chuck a question because, this is the person I need. And they'll fire a mechanical, technical question at you. It's often simple stuff, so you can answer and help. but that's still another 3 or 4 minutes. And we get probably 100 messages a day across all the platforms, not just YouTube, but also Instagram and emails. People will do all sorts to find a way to you. They'll see 300 comments in a video and they'll kind of think, well, I'm never going to get heard. So you'll find messages coming in on Instagram, messages coming in on personal emails. So somehow they routed out my personal email and fired it in on that. Always answer, because obviously then it does help them. And sometimes it's critical. It's a safety issue and they've got to get to work, you know.
I think what the most amazing part about it is, Del, and I say this truly from watching a lot of your videos from my own point of view, trying to help myself to do the things that you're talking about, that if you are in this wonderful kind of love affair that we have with motorcycles, that you need to look after them and make sure they are safe. Fundamentally, that's what we're talking about here, because it's a bit different to your car going to bin it. You've got four wheels to kind of balance that out. If it's not quite right on a motorbike, I think you can find that out pretty quickly. But that ability to be able to know what it is and how to deliver it, and you talk about the editing in your approach between yourself and your partner, it's that ability to convey the message without sounding condescending. Do you know what I mean? You're not there. I mean, essentially, you are there telling us what to do, but you do it in such a way that it draws you in. And is that a natural thing for you? Have you worked on delivery? Because from what I could see from minute one, the vibe, I mean, obviously production levels change as you kind of get down the road 15 years in. But the message and the delivery of the message, I think, has been super consistent and high standard from day one.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I mean, it is something I work on, because I'm ever conscious not wishing to teach people how to suck eggs. Your audience is a broad range of knowledge bases. I've had contact from technicians, people who are Harley Davidson master technicians, who've said, I watched what you said there. Mm. Well explained, nice one. Got it, mate. You got that right. Other people will soon call you out as well if you get something wrong or you make a statement that's not quite right. So you've got to convey the message without being patronizing, because we've done our demographic. We know who's watching. Our average age viewer is between 45 and 65. So we're not talking to youngsters. We are talking to people who know a bit. Also, lots of people know about cars and they know about other stuff. But they may not know about that particular issue in a motorcycle. A lot of it's about anatomy. A lot of people are worried that you take a cover or a casing off your engine to make an internal adjustment. Something goes ping, disappears into another dimension, and suddenly that's £1,000 bill because, oh my God, I've got to get a trailer and take it to the dealer, and they're all going to laugh at me and think I'm an idiot. So there's a matter of dignity and pride. Nobody wants to admit they made a mistake. Mm. So obviously they just want to find out how to do it. A monkey see, monkey do. If we watch somebody do something, it's 10 times easier than reading it in a manual in dialect that's written, or sorry, dialogue that's written by a technical person. I have a friend who writes manuals for car maintenance. It's his profession. And he is the most insanely boring and technical person, you know. You know the old thing, the glass is half full and the glass is half empty. No, no, no. To him, the receptacle is double the capacity it's required to be for the job in hand. He will send you to sleep. And that's the trouble. Manuals tend to skip over things and they like it seen. So, we try and explain it in a simple way, but really conscious. It worries me that sometimes you're patronizing people. So it's always a balance that we try and achieve.
You're clearly very articulate, and like Prot says, you come across really well, and I think you've got that right balance, you know, when you're talking to your audience. But how important are those 100-odd messages that come through on every video? Do you sort of look at those messages and think, hang on a minute, my viewers really want to see a bit more of this? Or do those, I suppose what I'm trying to ask is, do those questions that come in dictate perhaps your next video or the direction you're going to go in, or do you just do your own thing? Because clearly it means a lot what people ask you.
Yeah, it does. And in some ways, they are the script, for the next video and certainly the future direction. Because as much as maintenance work, we also do projects as well. So I'll buy an old bike and we'll make a project of it. We've just had a recent project that we're currently on, which anybody who's been watching will know about, the Goldwing project. A little crisis within that. We found some distortion in the frame. But we have got a direction for it. And we learned some amazing things. And the suggestions that come in from people are... They're critical. Without them, we wouldn't be where we are. And I know it's a bit of a cliche, but we do owe everything to our audience, because you're not a channel without one. And by and large, everybody is polite and helpful. And even if people are clumsy in the way that they put their helpful suggestion, it doesn't matter. As long as they get the message and understand it, And so many times, countless times, a piece of information that's come in through the comments, I didn't know that. I researched it, found out that it's actually correct because I do double check things because everybody's got an opinion. Some information, when you get it, it's been regurgitated. People will read it lower in the comments. They'll expand on it, pad it out a bit, regurgitate it like it's theirs. And that's fine. But the general message comes through. So, yeah, it's a helpful thing on another level. It really is. And I've learned as much from our viewers as I've ever managed to convey in videos in 15 years, for sure.
That process, Del, of knowing what you're going to do. You talk about the gold wing. You talk about, I've watched so many of your Triumph videos with regards to tidying up the back end or switching out exhausts and the general maintenance of quite beautiful bikes. You talk about the Sportster as well. How far ahead do you have to plan? Are you able to go down whichever avenue you want, with whichever bike you want? Or given how you can actually gauge what YouTube's telling you and what your viewers want, do you lean it more towards that, to the audience?
I think when you start a project, that's certainly we do. If you imagine two avenues, two roads that we follow, one is maintenance. I've got a few bikes. I've got friends and family with bikes. And when maintenance jobs come up, we use the opportunity to create a little how-to, to create a little tutorial and put that online.
Yeah.
And when we're not doing project stuff or we haven't uploaded a video for 2 days or something, then you'll watch all the comments are coming in on videos that are way older. In fact, this very morning, a video question came in on a video that's 14 years old about just to clarify something.
No
so
way.
They still have, they're still working. And that's a privilege. But with the projects, as you ask, we do have a direction at the beginning, but we keep it loose and we keep it fluid. I'll buy all the basic stuff. You might have seen recently, I've literally just published a video on the Triumph Legend that we intend to turn into a scrambler. So currently Triumph make their classic range or their modern classic range. They're currently all twins, except for the single 400, but there are no triples. All the three-cylinder Triumph engines are in the adventure bikes or in the sport nakeds and so on. And there isn't one in a scrambler. So we wanted to make a Legend into a scrambler. And it's got 17-inch wheels. So just to answer Ewan's question a minute ago, we had somebody suggest, if you're going to make a scrambler, you need a 19 or 21-inch front wheel. Quite correct. It just skidded past. I was looking around the bike on the introduction of that project. It's got 17-inch wheels front and rear. You can buy knobbly tires for those. But as somebody rightly pointed out, that's going to be a supermoto. If you want a scrambler, you need a bigger front wheel for obvious reasons. So a taller one. So that's now a direction I'm following. So yeah, we keep it fluid. We keep the directions of everything completely loose and we don't film more than about a month ahead, because if you do and you load up a video that's more than 2 weeks old, someone will suggest something that it's already too late for you to change. So we keep it fluid so that for the comments coming in are still reasonably current and in time for me to do something about that comment that I may want to. Mm. So yeah, fluid, but sort of loosely planned. Mm.
It's clear, isn't it? Perhaps the passion in your voice for bikes. But I want to know, how long has this been going on? You mentioned you got a few bikes. When did this love affair for you start? I mean, for me, it was a young boy. I had a scrambler. My dad had bikes. I've always been around motorbikes. Was the same case for you, or are you late to bikes in terms of riding and enjoying them?
Yeah, slightly different in that lots of lads say I started riding when I was 3, off-road and all that. I didn't do that. I didn't ride a bike until I was 16. My old man bought me a Fizzy, an FS1E, when I was 16. It was only 2 years old. As a kind of lesson in finance for a young man, he made me buy it on a loan, and I paid my own loan. He stood the guarantor, as they do, and I maintained it. He taught me how to do the basic maintenance. And then the law was such for learner bikes back in the 1980s, you could have a 250 on L plates. So I bought a Yamaha RD250 and became a little Yamaha hooligan, and that was fun, you know. Cut the sleeves off a denim jacket, put some badges on it, and became a hooligan. And it just carried on. So I've done a count, because I'm a bit sad. I did a count recently. I kept a list of every bike I've had, and including 10 years in the bike trade, I've had 89 bikes registered to me in a lifetime of, what is it, 45 years or so riding. So I've never not had a bike. I've always ridden at least one bike. And when I worked in the bike trade, I didn't own one, but I had sort of custody of 60-odd bikes to ride every day. So there isn't an own one, because I didn't have the time to deal with it all. But now I have. You know, I think bikes are not, they're not just a lifestyle. I think the word lifestyle is wrong. It's a life, because lifestyle infers that it's a style you're following. You're doing an impression of it. It's something, a fashion that you might leave. Not for me. It's in the blood forever. It's my life. and I'll never not have a bike. Even if I can't ride it, I'll have it in the garage to ping elastic bands at. Just, I need a bike in my life to validate that. You know, that's just how it is.
Yeah. It's a great way of putting it, Del, because, yeah, lifestyle suggests it's affected, doesn't it, rather than actually something that is you and your bones and your blood and what you live in. It's a professional career that's in the bike trade that's gone into this immensely successful social media world. What, I mean, was it ever going to be anything else for you? Was there ever is there a sliding doors moment where we're not sat talking here on a podcast about bikes and you're doing something completely different?
Yeah, there was. I mean, I didn't train as I've got to say this out loud. I'm not a qualified motorcycle technician, and you don't need to be to do basic maintenance. That's part of the message of this channel in its entirety. My only formal training was a bus and truck fitter, which I think there's a certain famous person on the TV that's a truck fitter and is now probably a motorcycle god. And ultimately, I'm a humble mechanic. You know, we're talking about, but I've trained as a bus and truck fitter in the 1980s. And I think an engine's an engine. You know, changing oil is a domestic thing. I call it that because it's not something you need a technician for. Every engine from a 13-litre truck engine that weighs 3 tons, right up to a little moped engine, they've all got an oil drain plug, they've all got an oil filler plug, and they've all got a dipstick or a sight glass. Changing oil is easy. It's changing oil. Mm. And it's one of the most fundamental things of all your servicing. And the same with any other fluids. And a hydraulic system on a car is the same mechanical principles as on a motorcycle. So changing the brake fluid shouldn't be difficult. There are some technicalities as bikes get more complex with ABS systems that you need to consider, but it's still not something you can't get over with a little bit of thought and consideration. You just need practical hands, basic tools, common sense, and a sense of humour. Because once you've got that, then I think you can achieve anything.
Do you know what? It's interesting you say that about the sense of humour and a bit of confidence. Like, Prots will fall off his seat when he hears this. But I helped my mate take out and change a gearbox on a Ford F-250, big, big old truck at the weekend. And I'm not mechanically gifted.
And he's going to drive it again. I mean, my mate,
we tested it. It drove. And he was just saying to me, I'm not saying it's idiot-proof, but he said, look, that comes out of there. Make a note of where that bolt went. That goes into there. Do this. Use that. And I just thought, let's enjoy it. And I got mucky doing it. And it was really good fun. And I had a real sense of pride when I finished it. And I know I'd helped him. So I totally get it, Del, like in terms of you just got to go through it. And I'm not saying it's not rocket science, but it's not. You can do it. And I absolutely loved it. But what I wanted to ask you, I mean, it sounds to me like your dad was a good man in terms of he installed into you, you know, that discipline of you're going to pay for this bike. You're going to learn to look after it. Yeah. What was it like? Because you touched upon in your day, you could ride a 250 on L plates.
Yeah.
You probably changed the law for me because I'm slightly younger.
Sorry.
It was a 125 for me. Mm. But no, it's all right. It was you lot tearing around on 250s probably. But what was it like when you heard those words from that instructor, you've passed your test? Because I know what it felt like for me and Prats. I mean, when you heard that you'd passed your test and you took that and you could go get any bike you wanted, what was that like for you, that moment?
Well, it is a seminal moment for all of us, isn't it? It's one of those things that you remember where you were, you remember the person, what they looked like, sounded like, what their name was. And I think it was very easy for us. This has to be said out loud as well. Those of us Gen X who took our tests in the 70s and 80s, we had it simple. I didn't have to do a CBT. I didn't have to do a pursuit test. I drove around the block, that whole thing. I could have gone around the back of the block, fallen off, hit a skid lorry, come back round, dusted off, and then presented myself and still passed. Whereas obviously today, when you look at the nightmare, and I mean, it is a nightmare on wheels, what young people have to go through today to get on the road. It's 2 or 3 tests. I don't know. There's hazard perception. There's all this stuff they have to do. And it is way, way harder. But I still valued it then. And I must admit, because it's a memorable day, I did get shunted from behind by a car on a roundabout on the way home, and it totaled my bike, I was so elated about passing.
What?
I didn't give a damn. I was parked at a roundabout, and a car came up behind me, and it was that classic thing. There was a girl in front of me who just passed also. She pulled away, and then she stopped. So I pulled forward and stopped. The car behind me looked to the right, pulled away, and didn't realize we stopped. So just rammed me from behind and totaled the bike. Well, it kind of smashed on the back end. But to kind of verify or to sum up how I didn't care, you know, how elated I was at passing, I just kicked it all back into shape. It's no worries, mate. And I drove off. He got away with that. But
my
it's
word.
One of those things you never forget. And it was, what, 40, 44 years ago. So it's a long time, but you never forget that day. It's incredible. And a license is a privilege. A license to ride a motorcycle is even more of a privilege now. Yeah. One thing we did have a lot of when I was working in the bike trade, there was a time when the glorious people at DVLA, they lost a lot of the records of ancient historic licenses. So a lot of guys were coming into the bike shop saying, I had a bike license. I sent my license back for renewal and it's come back without my motorcycle entitlement. And this was a thing. Anybody might remember this. And it was due to a fire or a flood or something at DVLA in Wales. And they had to retake their tests. And they were quite angry at it.
No.
We did a deal. Yeah, seriously, there were guys coming in who'd been riding 20 years, but they'd not ridden. What it was, there was a conspiracy theory that DVLA were kind of trying to delete motorcycle licenses that hadn't been registered to the ownership of a bike for 20 years. So it's when people had a bike, they passed their test, never bothered riding a bike. 25 years later, they decided to get one, and they were seeing quite a high accident rate amongst what was back then termed as born-again riders. So right. I think if some say it was a conspiracy, I don't think so. I think it genuinely was an error technically with the information. So whenever I, from that day on, send my license, even to this day, back to DVLA for anything, I photocopy it. Because what they said, if you can produce your pass certificate or your CBT certificate or even a photocopy of your license, we'll grant your bike entitlement. But they couldn't because they just sent it back and didn't care. It was the old paper fold-up license that went in a wallet. So to answer your question, lots of guys were coming in ranting, and I mean foaming at the mouth that they would been disallowed to ride. And what can they do? So we were doing a course as the motorcycle shop that I work for. We were doing a back to biking course, which was one day's training and a test. And nearly every guy passed it because they were already riders and women as well. So that's how valuable your bike test and your license is. It's a precious thing when bikes are your life, for sure.
I mean, that word entitlement is so right as well, because it goes back to that privilege of being able to ride two bikes. So a slight sidebar about licenses. Me and a very good friend of mine, we'd hired a car 20 odd years ago over in America and doing the cruising around thing. I'm sure one of us had our tops off because it was boiling up. Convertible car. Just imagine these two kids, Dale, driving around doing this. And this cop pulls us over for some minor infraction, because obviously the driving laws are slightly different over there. And my friend proceeds to get his license out the paper part, which looked about 50 years old. So the fella's unfolding this bit of paper that's fallen apart, and he just went, oh God, just right, take that, stop doing that, and bugger off. Just like that's unfolding it. The whole thing like an ancient manuscript. Ridiculous. Let's have a quick bit of mid-show housekeeping. If you haven't already, please press subscribe on YouTube to never miss an episode, or press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts from. So, Dale, you mentioned a 250 with L plates on.
Yeah.
How quickly did you go through the gears to get what we would class as a bigger bike? Did you want to get to a bigger engine pretty swiftly, or did you take your time?
No, it was a forced thing, because the 125 law, which we all know about, was changed in 1983, I think. 1982, 1983, the 125, I wasn't about to get off my, at the time, I had an RD250 LC. And there was no way I was giving that up for some little 125. It wasn't going to happen. So I took a test and immediately got a Suzuki GS750. That was my first proper big bike. Again, still remember it. I mean, it's an absolute lorry. No brake horsepower, bendy frame and no brakes and 3-inch wide tires. But it was a big, hefty bike. So, you know, it's that thing. I've said this a few times, actually. I sometimes wish, after 80-odd bikes and a lifetime riding, that I could get back that feeling of being on that big, enormous Suzuki GS for the first time. It felt like a lorry sitting on this massive, vast thing, because an RD250 is quite a small bike. If you sit on it now, you feel like you're a monkey on a football. It's tiny. And when you get on a bigger bike, that's... So a little while ago, I bought a Triumph Rocket, and that was just for a minute. I felt that lovely, glorious feeling sitting on this bike that actually scares me, because it was like sitting on a house.
Huge.
You get to a corner, it's like trying to hustle a bungalow around a bend. It's just massive. So I do. I love big bikes, probably because of harking back to that feeling of being on my first big 750 when I was, 17 years old.
Well, you said already you've had over 80-odd bikes. We won't ask you what your favourite is, but what's in your current collection? I mean, we've already established we're all very, very honoured and lucky to ride bikes, but what have you got in the garage at the moment?
Well, I think I just showed it on a few videos recently. I've got an Indian Pursuit Dark Horse, which is pride and joy at the minute. I absolutely love that. It's a fantastic bike. I've had Harleys for probably about 30 years since my first, I think, memorable bikes. I had an XLCH, which is an Ironhead 1000 Harley Sportster. And I had that was just, I think I paid a pittance for it. It was a bit of an old mech, a wreck, and I had to do it up. But I got it sorted and together and made a custom bike of it, then sold it and bought a big twin. And it was an ex-police bike. So I kind of got the taste for a big batwing fairing and boxes. And I love big touring bikes. And recently had an Ultra a while ago. So it's a Harley Electroglide Ultra Classic. So that's a big old fat heavy very bike. Nice. Mm. And I went for a test ride on an Indian Pursuit, which is, I suppose, the competition to Harley. And it's another world. It's an incredible bike. It combines power and a rigid frame and performance and handling with a big, massive, vast bungalow of a bike. So I absolutely love it. I love that. And, of course, the project bikes you've seen. I've got the Triumph Legend, which I picked up for an absolute song. That's going to be a scrambler. And that will be a keeper. I want to keep that because we live, as you said earlier, we've got some nice off-road areas around here. And I will be looking forward to getting that mucky. And of course, whatever happens to the Goldwing, we have got a future for that. The project isn't dead. We did discover that the frame was bent, but that's it's not unsurmountable. And thanks to some suggestions from all of the viewers, we'll be getting that going as a project and on the road. So where that goes in the future, I don't know. I'm not planning any real future for it, but it's the Indian Pursuit and that Triumph Legend at the moment, because I think what they do for me is they give you two opposites. The big Indian Pursuit, the two of us on that touring around Scotland, I still haven't got to do the big tour around Scotland, the 500. I'm desperate to do that in the future. It will happen. But you can't do it on a Triumph Scrambler, not really, not two of you. So that will be the bike for hammering around here and remaining, keeping the faith, the hooligan faith, which I'm determined to keep until I'm too old to ride. I will definitely be a hooligan until the day I can't ride.
I always keep that inner hooligan. Del, given the size of the following and the platform that you've got, are you bumping into people out and about on your bike? Do people recognise you? Do they recognise the bikes maybe when you pull up at a petrol station?
Yeah, they do. I mean, there's not a place we've been to we haven't been recognised by someone or other. And it's always been a fantastic experience to meet people in the flesh, because when you're this side of the camera, you don't get to meet people, and people are far more themselves in person. And when they've got time to chat, they always want to tell you about their bikes, and I love to hear about their tales and their stories. So it's great. Yeah. Almost everywhere we go, if I wear this and I put a black hoodie on, then yeah, guaranteed every single time. But I can be in the cognitos
The Del Boy uniform.
Yeah. If I take the cap off and I can put just a different top on or something, then it's not so common, but it still happens. And it's great. It's great to meet people. It really is. It's been, I love people. I love talking to people and finding out. We're a gregarious bunch of bikers, aren't we? So I do like to go to bike meets when I get time and just catch up with it. But I tell you what I do get. A couple of my mates said that for a while, they said, we're going to change your name to Adele. And I said, Adele, why is that? He said, well, every time we go to a bike meet, someone comes up to you and says, Adele, my bike, can you just have a look at this for me? So that kind of got tapped on the side.
I thought you were going to start singing for us. I thought there was a secret. You've got an amazing, beautiful voice.
I definitely haven't. But I must admit, it is nice to get asked. People do ask you if you can help them sort a problem out. And that's just a live version of what we do online. So I love it. I'll never tire of it.
It's lovely the fact that you like being recognised and you don't mind chatting to people. We're glad of that because you're talking to us. It'd be rubbish if you didn't like talking to people.
Back in the podcast pretty quickly, wouldn't it?
For someone who's not part of the biking world, perhaps there's someone watching this who's not part of that community, what in your eyes makes it so special? Because it is like a brotherhood, it's a sisterhood, isn't it? But bikers stick together. What makes it special for you?
I think it's a glue that sticks all road users together. I don't think if you're riding up the road, you can spot the car drivers that ride a bike. They're the ones when you're filtering that will pull right over to the left and willfully let you by. They'll ping a left indicator and let you go. Truck drivers. I find there's an incredible amount of truck drivers love what we are. They love bikes. They'll pull over and let you through. And in France, oh my goodness, we were riding in France and the trucks there, they pull in the hedge. They're plowing for you. You see there's big plumes of muck and foliage piling out the right-hand side of the truck as they pull over to let you through. So, yeah, there's a great love for bikes. And I think it's a it's a great leveler as well, because, you know, look who rides bikes. Everybody, from, you know, all creatures great and small, we all ride bikes. It doesn't matter how much money you've got, you can still ride a cheap motorcycle. Motorcycles are not expensive. I mean, when I was in the bike trade, one of our customers, a very wealthy customer, he would always come and visit us in a house price Italian sports car kind of thing. And he would make his comment was, bikes are cheap, and bikes are cheap, because for 1,500 quid or less, you can buy a reasonably nice, usable, safe motorcycle and go and have the same adventures as somebody on a 30,000 pound CVO Harley. You know, a bike's a bike. It doesn't matter what you ride. It just matters that you ride. And I know that's a cliche, but it's a true one. And talking to many instructors that I know, one in particular, a chap called Roadcraft Nottingham, he's an advanced instructor, and he takes a lot of riders out who've had, like us, a lifetime on the road. And you can sign up to these guys for the price of a breakfast or less. You can get sharpened up on all your skills, because we need those skills, because the roads are getting busier. There are, what is it? I think the statistic is 100 to 1. There's 100 cars on the road for every motorcycle, which is why we all wave and nod at each other to some degree or other, because we're rare.
Yeah.
If you look at it, take that to the commercial vehicle world, truck drivers very rarely nod or wave at each other, but coach drivers always do. Because coach, and I did that job for a short while, coach drivers, they're rare. There's one or two coaches on the road for every 50 trucks. And that's what it's with bikes. There's only one of us for every single car on the road. So that means we're vulnerable, all of those good things. And of course, we have an affinity with the cold weather and the vulnerability and the dangerous lifestyle that we lead, or life that we lead riding on the roads. So yeah, there's always going to be a joint understanding between people on bikes. Try pulling up at anywhere, even a supermarket, and you pull up and there's a bike outside, you've got a conversation. You only have to nod at someone, say hello, ask them about their bike, and you can be chatting for an hour and make a friend. That's fantastic. That will never get old.
There's something in that when you're in it together. It's glorious on sunny days, but there is that kind of grim in the trenches together feeling when you go past someone and it's launching it down. You're both trying to get home as soon as possible. And, you know, at some stage, this miserable journey that we normally love so much is going to be over. You're going to be dry. You're going to have a cup of coffee, cup of tea, whatever. It is amazing. It's funny what you say that about driving on the continent, because there is a lot of it which is like wacky races, but that's just completely jogged my memory about truck drivers in France, where you are literally going, oh my God, he's going to drive off the road, like straight over like that. And then you can fly in badge, you get a big wave, like, cheers, Bob, thank you very much. And you think of all the people, and this is not casting aspersions, French truck drivers are really friendly.
They are. And I think also when you get, I've never found truck, the only people, I think it's a dark thing when a car makes a move that you think is probably deliberate to block you, then, you know, and you think they don't want you. That's a dark thing when that happens, and it does happen. Mm-hmm. And there are always angry people on the road. But I also noticed one thing, that I've experienced more road rage in my car than I ever have on a bike.
Yeah.
Because you're normally just off out the way. And this comes to others. I see riders these days, they tend to sit in the traffic and just go along with the traffic. And I don't know whether it's my hooligan thing that's never died out. I have to filter. Everywhere I ride, I'm filtering. If it's legal, obviously, and safe, I'm filtering as safely as I can. And people expect it. And the minute you do it, pull up in that 7 o'clock or 5 o'clock position on a car and give them that obvious dominating of the space, and there they go. They're over to the left. It's almost like an unwritten thing. So, yeah, I think all road users do understand bikes. There's these great things you see on the internet, that if you teach your children to count motorcycles when they're out with you in the car, then they'll always see motorcycles on the road when they become a driver in the future. So all of those things help. You never heard of that, obviously.
No, it's getting them off the phones, isn't it?
It goes something like, when your children are out in the car, teach them to count motorcycles on the journey. See how many they can count. It just makes them look for motorcycles, apparently.
Okay, I'll definitely do that. Del, just while you're here, like a bit like the people that see you at bike meets and elsewhere, Del, can I ask you about my bike, which is a Triumph Bonneville Bobber Black. I mean, and the crushing irony of this, because it's been a very wet winter, And it's obviously been a bit grim up north, though, so I haven't really been out on it. But it's been in a Triumph dealership being serviced. And the irony of speaking to you just a week after getting it back. Oh, God. And when you're kind of speaking to them, they go, well, it needs this, it needs that. And you're going, that sounds like a lot of stuff here. And you get that glazed over expression thinking, you're now talking about things I've got absolutely no idea what they are, but I trust you, fingers crossed, that you're not pulling my pants down. So I've done the oil changes and fluids in the past. This is a genuine thing, not because you're here and we're blowing smoke up your ass, but it was literally watching your tutorials right. about how to do it and kind of working your way through it. But, you know, when you see kind of like the home computer systems that you can plug into these bikes now that talk to you in all different manners of ways, right. is that something that you would suggest investing in for lay people like ourselves to be able to do bits and bobs like that? Because you see the spanner thing come up on the readout and you think, oh, it's got a, you know what I mean? And all the different kind of codes that are punched in or sometimes told that you and just slightly different because of the custom nature of his. Would I benefit from having that type of thing?
You mean a diagnostic?
Yes, a diagnostic. See, I don't even know the terminology for it, Del, so maybe that answers the question.
I mean, any of the analytic tools can be helpful, but I would say you don't need it. That's the crux word. You don't need one. Because a diagnostic, your dealership, if they are a decent dealership, and I've never found a Triumph dealership that isn't, or a Harley dealership, they're all good enough to say, look, I've got a management light. I've got my, you know, if you get some of the Harley Davidson series, not so much on your Triumph, but they have a code that will come up on the dash. And that code is the bike telling you. You don't actually, the bike's itself diagnostic. You can then literally Google that code. Yeah. It will tell you what the problem is. And then you can make a judgment on whether you can fix it or whether you need to get someone else. But if you need, I personally don't own any of those. I don't feel the need for them because I prefer to go to the dealer. Now, the technicians, the actual proper qualified motorcycle master technicians that I know, those guys spend a ridiculous and insane amount of money on their tools and equipment. And well over half of it is diagnostic tools. So they already own them. So for half an hour's labor to go in, what is that? 40, 50 pounds. You don't only get what's exactly wrong, reliably that you can trust. You can also get a quote on the parts if you just want to buy the parts and do it yourself or the job entirely. So you get choices, and choices are what it's all about. Mm. We make choices based on things that we know, information. And those tools that you're asking about, they give you information. But I think the use of those diagnostic tools is a qualified, not qualified, but it's a skilled thing. You have to understand. You know, they might tell you that it's, I know, crank position sensor. Fine. So you've got the information, but do you know what that means? And do you know what to do about something showing a fault with the crank position sensor or throttle position sensor or something? It's better to pass that over. I've always said in videos for some time that do your basic domestic maintenance. Change your oil, change your brake fluid, change your brake pads, change your fork oil. If you've got a Harley Davidson, do your gearbox oil in your primary oil, do your clutch adjustment. All those things are mechanical. They're about spanners and screwdrivers, and they're doable. But once it comes to diagnostics, that's the time to have the humility to hand it over, and I will do exactly that myself because that's above my remit. And the best assembly for that, to way to kind of explain it, if you go to your GP for a diagnosis on a something that's wrong that you feel unwell, they may refer you to a specialist, but you're not going to ask Google because that's just going to tell you a symptom that might not actually be right. So go to a professional when it's an engine management light. Because honestly, they're there for a reason and they're there to save you money because it's a warning that something's up. If you just ignore it, there's these god-awful things that you see where you can get a light extinguished so it'll pass its MOT. That's just an idiotic thing to do because all you're doing is closing your eyes to
that's
the problem.
That's ridiculous.
Ignoring it.
Just put a plaster on it, aren't you? Yeah.
So there's no reason. No, so to finalize your question, yeah, for sure. I wouldn't bother buying diagnostic plug-in tools. You don't really need them. Your dealer is always prepared to offer that service for a small fee.
Right, Del, we've got. I mean, they're quite serious questions. It's amazing, mate. We're just watching myself and you, and just sat there agog, going, "Yeah, I'm making notes again. Make sure you do that. Make sure you do that." It's been wonderful. So we've got something a little bit more frivolous now, which is a quick final round of quick questions before Ewan's big question, which comes later on. It's got 60 seconds. We've got a lot of questions to chuck at you. Quick answers. It'll be either or answers, and you'll be able to say whatever. And then we'll get to the end of it. We'll give you a score. And as I normally say in this, whatever that score means to you is what it means to you. To you, mate.
Oh dear, I didn't
no
know
prizes coming this. Your way anytime soon.
There's no Bluetooth radio or cup of coffee coming. It's just pride.
Right.
Just pride, which we all know comes before a fall. Right.
Oh, definitely.
Let's get going. Right. I'm going to put 60 seconds on here and then you can start you. Are you ready?
Yep.
So ready, Del?
Yep.
3, 2, 1, go.
Who was your motorcycling hero growing up?
Evel Knievel.
What posters did you have on your bedroom wall?
Evel Knievel. Oh, and probably Guns N' Roses.
No. Oh, yes. American bikes or British bikes?
British bikes.
Favourite chocolate biscuit for a mid-afternoon snack?
Chocolate digestive.
Nice.
Are you dunking that in tea or coffee?
Definitely in tea.
What do you listen to in the garage?
Instructions from the camera lady and producer.
Good answer.
Indian or Harley?
Right. Got to be honest, Indian. At this point, Indian.
Norton or Triumph? Last one.
Triumph. No experience of Norton whatsoever, so definitely Triumph.
Time's up. Let me just top this up, gents.
Oh,
fab
God,
stuff.
Here we go.
Fab stuff. No. Nine. Nine's a good score in any demo graphic that I think of, Del. I think that sounds pretty good. Like I said, there's no T-shirt on the way. There's no bottle of champagne, but you attacked it with gusto. Thank you.
There you go.
Lovely.
Nine is brilliant, unless we're talking in Germany. Yeah. Right.
Yes,
time for your final question now, Del.
Right, go on.
No. Right, we would, and I think you can have a belter here. So we would like to know your ideal fantasy ride. So you can ride any road in the world. You can be on any bike you choose. You can have company or you can be going solo and you can have the soundtrack of your life. So what music are you listening to? What bike are you on? Where are you going? And are you with anyone?
Right, definitely with Penny Pitstop on the back of the bike. My camera girl and 40-year partner and wife. So definitely. And definitely on the Indian Pursuit. And it would be as many European countries as I can possibly visit in that time. And if that means all of them, then fantastic. And obviously at a peacetime where it's possible to do it, but definitely. And as far as music's concerned, apart from saying whatever she wants to listen to, then obviously I reckon I love Mafra at the moment. I love thrash metal. I love older school heavy metal, that sort of thing. And of course, going back to my youth, I love ska. So some proper Jamaican ska. Mm. I know it's a bit of an eclectic pair to listen to, but I love ska music as well. So just anything except pop music. Because I've got no time for that. Was that all of you? Have I covered all of it?
That's lovely. Yeah, that's different to what we've had before, isn't it?
The thing is, as well, Ewan, that was answered in what we can now see, having had the pleasure of Del's company, is in Del's inimitable manner. There, it was to the point. It was succinct. Yeah. It covered every single base and every single question that we asked of you, mate.
It wasn't at all wishy-washy. It was methodical. It was like you were picking up a socket set. It was, I'm going that. There's my answer. Loved it.
Just to say for both of you, if ever you need anything, you know, if you've got questions answered, stuff you're stuck with, then just drop me a line. You can catch me online or drop me a line on the channel email privately. I'm always happy to help. And if I don't know the answer, I'll find it out for you and get back to you with a solution. It's always an honour to help.
It's Del, this has been amazing. And unfortunately, that's it for this week's edition of Full Chat, powered by Bikeshore, of course. As UK's largest independent motorcycling cycle insurance broker, Bikeshore will set a quote to your exact needs on whatever you ride with two wheels.
As Prutz said, it's been an absolute pleasure and a joy and definitely a lesson for me. Thank you so much to this week's guest. He's been absolutely brilliant. Of course, Del from Del Boys Garage. If you don't follow him, get onto his channels because you're going to learn something, as we have today.
Thanks, guys.
No, it's been wonderful. Follow Del, follow us, press subscribe on YouTube so you never miss an episode of either us or Del Boys Garage, or press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from.
As ever, thank you so much to everybody for listening and watching. Until next time, see you later.